You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
14 Mission 2, San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to the Datebook Podcast. I'm pop culture critic Peter Hartlob, here with Mick LaSalle for Movies with Mick LaSalle. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
A lot going on in this episode, a lot of movies, but yeah. you mentioned the Castro Theater and what's good and bad about it. I'll let listeners wait to hear about that.
Okay, sure.
But I wanted to ask you, where's your favorite place to see a movie, see either a screening or just go see a movie in San Francisco?
Okay, well, if it's a screening, I just like whatever theater is closest to my house because then I'm working. But if I'm talking about the theater that means most to me in San Francisco, it's the Roxy Theater. It used to be the Roxy Cinema, because that place was the scene of some of my great memories as a critic. I mean, they did the Norma Shearer Festival in 1994. They did the Lon Chaney Festival in 1995. No, that was 94 too. But it's just one great thing after another. They did all these great Hong Kong movies when they were coming out then, like Naked Killer. And so just when I go there, there's a smell in the lobby. It's the smell of coffee. They make coffee. Uh-huh. And I just have this kind of a sensory, it just takes me back to these wonderful moments.
Well, there's been so many near-death experiences with the Roxy,
yeah.
And it's just so great that it's still there.
Yeah, it is still there, and I think that they're making money. They're actually doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're starting with a positive. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's mostly positive.
Yeah. So, Lieber Hertz returns today. You're going to talk about Annabelle Comes Home, the Beatles-themed movie Yesterday, and two upcoming movies, Midsommar and Spider-Man Far From Home. Datebook Podcast, thanks for listening.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Mick LaSalle, and welcome to Movies with Mick LaSalle. I am here with my former editor, the late, great the great Lieber Hertz. Hi, Lieber.
Hi, everybody.
And we are here to talk about the movies of the last 2 weeks and also, upcoming in the sense that, it depends. I don't know when this is going to post. But also, we're going to be talking about two upcoming movies for next week, which are Midsommar. And also Spider-Man.
Oh, Spider-Man's next week.
Spider-Man is next week. Yeah,
yeah. Because of the 4th of July holiday.
Yeah, the 4th of July. Yeah, they're doing that. So anyway, Lieber, how are you? What's going on?
I'm really good. On Wednesday night, I was at the Castro for the Frameline Festival, and it's a terrific documentary called Sid and Judy about Judy Garland and her husband Sid Luft with voiceovers of reading some of the stuff or acting, including John Hamm as Sid, and yeah. One of your favorites, Jennifer Jason Leigh, is Judy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
And it was at one point in the middle of the
movie.
Oh, that could be good. It was just a magical night, and at one point, she sings a duet with Barbara Streisand. People know this, it's not a spoiler. And the movie, if they could have stopped the movie, then they would have, because the whole audience just erupted in applause. It was absolutely a magical moment.
Every so often you get them in the movie theater. They're just wonderful. Yeah. Although, the Castro, that happens more often than not. I mean, the Castro, I find that the Castro is usually horrible for repertory, because you have an audience there that comes there wanting to make wisecracks, and unless it's a comedy from 1939 or something, as opposed to a drama, if they're there for a drama, they just wisecrack their way through it, and it's annoying. But for new movies, to see a debut, Castro is amazing. It's just so good to see a debut there. And first of all, the theater is great, but there's just just great audiences there, just wonderful audiences. So anyway, I guess we should take a look at some of the movies that are coming out on Friday, June 28th.
What about the June 21st movie?
Do we we'll save that for later.
Yeah, yeah, okay, we'll June 28th. We had Too Late to Die Young.
Oh, wow. Okay, we're starting on the bottom here. This is a movie. Now, this movie, I'd almost be curious. I'd be curious to see what other people would have to say about this movie. Like, if I were right now talking to if this was a conversation rather than me actually, you know, me and you talking at people, I would love to hear what they had to say, except they haven't seen the movie, but I'd love to know if they did see it, because this is what's weird. This movie has gotten rave reviews across the country, like 97% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And you're the 3%.
I'm the 3%. Not, but I'm completely baffled about what anything, what any good can be said for this movie. I'll tell you what it's about. It's it takes place in it's a Chilean film. It takes place in the woods. It's like these families go away to the woods for the holiday, in what we would call the summer. Actually, it's not the summer because it's, you know, the southern hemisphere. So they go, it's like 90 degrees, but they're celebrating New Year's. Sounds kind of fun, actually. Yeah. That part I like. And it's about, mainly it's about everybody and it's about nobody. It's just about these, all these families who are all camping out. But it's also about this 16-year-old girl, and she likes some kid who likes her, but then she likes this other guy who's a little bit older, maybe he's in his 20s, and they both like her. And it's like, who cares? It's like going on vacation with these people that you don't care about. And then it's set in 1990, we're told. No accommodation is made to the era that I can tell, except for the fact that the girl in the story has Sinead O'Connor pictures up on her mirror, which is, you know, nobody would do that past 1992, I don't think.
And Allende has been overthrown already.
Oh, no, Allende is 73, but yeah
he's
no,
gone.
The,
he's
no,
gone.
No, but the crucial thing is that in 1990, Pinochet is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the movie's taking place after Pinochet is gone, so these people are newly free. But I defy anybody, well, I don't defy anybody, because there's a million reviews that say it's there. I don't see, like, how you can tell that Pinochet is gone. I don't really get it. So I would really like some, you know, people, if, I would love for people to say, oh, no, the part that you missed is this, because I look at this movie and I don't see anything. And then I went and started, after I wrote it, I looked at some of the reviews, and I'm baffled by what they saw, what they enjoyed. They talk about how a mood is created. You know, whenever, I'll tell you something, whenever a movie's bad, people talk about a mood is created. Sometimes a mood is created. But when you have, you know, nobody says about The Godfather, a mood is created, although a mood is created because there's a great story, scene by scene, there's a great script, great acting. If you're reduced to saying a mood is created, usually you're talking about a bad movie. But to believe though that 97% of the people are somehow being intimidated into giving a good review on the basis of maybe this filmmaker's previous
That's
work.
What I was going to ask you about.
It's Dominguez Sotomayor. I haven't seen her previous film, but it was very respected. I don't get it. I don't believe it. I think people actually do like the movie. They're seeing things in it that I'm not seeing, but I don't necessarily think general audiences will agree with them.
I also felt the same way about The Souvenir, which, if you look at the consensus that runs in the Sunday Pink, is at the top of the list, and I thought it was terrible.
Yeah.
And should we say what we call this?
Oh, well, yeah, I don't know if it qualifies, but you say it, though.
It's kind of the Vera Drake syndrome.
Well, I'm not sure if this is the Vera Drake syndrome. I'm not sure. The Vera Drake syndrome, this is Lieba's phrase for a movie that people feel obligated to like because it's so nice. This movie isn't so nice, but there is that phenomenon. And not only that, but not only you would, in the case of Vera Drake, everybody gave it a good review, but I even gave it a good review.
And I told him to give it a good review.
Yeah, it was like we were on drugs. And then about like 2 weeks later, we looked up and said, this thing is horrible.
The only thing good about it was the performance by Imelda Staunton. She was fantastic in the movie, but the rest of the movie was deadly dull.
The best thing about that movie is when they come in to arrest her. Her acting is really good, and it's really funny that she's getting arrested. It works both ways. If you like the movie, you say, wow, her acting is great. And if you don't like the movie, you say, finally, she's getting arrested, and isn't this funny? That movie, by the way, a good double feature, okay? Watch the Vera Drake story. No, Vera Drake. Vera Drake. Watch Vera Drake and then watch The Story of Women, which is a French movie with Isabelle Huppert. It is the same story. It takes place mid-century, and it's about some woman giving illegal abortions. And the beauty of the Story of Women is the woman in The Story of Women. It's Isabelle Huppert, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't care that she's killing people. She's just, I mean, she's actually like, she does things wrong. People die. Mm-hmm. And people come to her and they say, you know, my wife died because of you. And Isabelle Huppert has that blank expression. She's trying to make believe she cares. So it's like complete opposite. It's like the same story. Woman gets in trouble for doing illegal abortions, and a completely different sensibility. Mm-hmm. And one is so much better than the other.
Then there's the Romanian movie as well.
Oh, that's
which
a great well,
which is tremendous.
Well, that's not about a woman giving abortions, but yeah, that's one of the great movies of the 21st century.
Yeah.
That's 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Yeah,
that's by Christian Mungiu. That's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. That I tell you, if anybody hasn't seen that movie, that's something you can do this week. Go see that. You know, rent it, whatever. Get it
but
from
again,
Netflix.
But again, that's about illegal abortion again.
So. Yeah, it's about illegal abortion. In this case, it's a guy doing the abortion.
Right.
It's Mr. Baby.
Oh.
Mr. Bebe. Giving the abortions. It's so. That is a
devastating movie.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
What else we got? Let's turn to happier things.
Annabelle, Come Home.
Well, you know, I'm curious. This is another one. I'd be curious. I haven't gone on Rotten Tomatoes to look. I'd be curious how people react to this one. I liked it. I liked Annabelle Comes Home. And the reason why I liked it is sometimes the same reason why I like, you know, a movie like Dark Phoenix. It's a genre movie, but it's a genre movie in a way that I didn't expect. So, I this is a horror movie. And it's set up like it's a slasher movie. You know who's supposed to get killed, but nothing happens like you expect. And in fact, basically the whole movie takes place, the movie takes place, I guess it's like a 90-minute movie or something, but the things that happen in this movie, in another movie, would take 15 minutes to happen. Everything is elongated, but there's a lot of suspense. I think the acting is really good, and the acting is good across the board, which means that the director is good.
Who's the director?
I think it's Gary Dauberman.
Did he do the first one?
He has been involved in these. I think he's written some. I'm not sure if he's direct. I don't think he didn't direct the first one.
I believe the first one, our engineer here, Peter Hartlob, I think gave it a top rating or a clapping man.
Hi. I did not. I gave The Conjuring, which was kind of the genesis, the opening salvo of the Annabelle films, did get my highest rating, was in my top 10. I love The Conjuring 2. I think I gave the Annabelle first movie a 3, but it was a friendly 3. And James Wan is the producer, and he's the one who's kind of the mastermind.
And Walter gave the next one a relatively friendly 3. It wasn't a
friendly interested man.
Friendly interested man. Yeah, it wasn't Walter's usual, slice and dice. He was nice. Walt is the nicest guy in the world, but he's a tough critic.
Oh, he makes Mick, who everybody thinks is the toughest critic in the world, look like just a walk over the guy.
Walter. Well, the thing is with me, the reason why people think that I'm tough is because when I don't like something, I'm just sort of, it's like chopping down a tree. I just want to annihilate it. But actually, if you look, I'm considered. If you look at my averages and whatever the aggregators are, I'm actually pretty easygoing guy. Not quite like the late Roger Ebert, who liked everything, but Roger Ebert should have liked everything because he was so influential that he could wreck everybody. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Roger Ebert's place, you want the first port of entry to like let you in and then let the piranhas get you later on. If you have a piranha at the door, it would have been a terrible thing. I think he used his power
And Vincent Canby also liked everything. And my judgment from Vincent Canby, if he liked a movie, I may or may not go. If he hated a movie, I would never go, because he really, if it was bad, if he didn't like it, you knew it was bad.
And Vincent Canby, we should identify to those who are...
New York Times.
Yeah, New York Times critic. Because before he retired, he became a theater critic, too. So he was there. That's what we're talking a while ago.
Yeah.
Like Janet Maslin days.
Yeah.
Okay, so so I liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was well done. I thought the little girl in it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I thought she was just terrific. And Vera Farmiga was very good, too.
Oh, that's why you liked it.
Oh, she's barely in it. Yeah. She's barely in it, but she's very... She's like
can't
in three
scenes. I can't blame Mick. She's marvelous, and she deserves a better fate in her career.
I didn't know I was like this guy who liked Vera Farmiga.
Oh, yeah. You always like Vera Farmiga.
Yeah? I mean, that's funny. I know I like Jennifer Aniston,
I know you
but
like
I didn't
that, but,
know.
But Vera Farmiga has more legitimacy than Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah. I tell you, I'm now at the stage where... It's weird, you know. I'm seeing, you know, women in movies, and I'm getting too old for them, even in the realm of fantasy. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well,
like, what I'm saying is, like, if I'm 40 years old or I'm 35 years old, and I'm watching a movie with like a 30-year-old leading lady, I could imagine it's conceivable that she might like me if I had enough money for her to like me, right? I mean, there would be like some way. But now I see, because still I watch a movie not as if I'm 60. I watch a movie as if I'm just me, like this pure essence, this platonic ideal of myself watching a movie. And I'm watching a movie and I'm saying, oh, wow, Lily James.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, she's so nice. And, oh, Lily James, yeah. Oh, I'm old enough to be Lily James's father's older brother.
Which gets us to our next movie.
Yeah, it gets us to our next movie.
And I'm
movie.
Really confused about the title of the movie. It's about, the title of the movie is a song I never heard of.
Yesterday. Yeah, I know. Because
I never
the
heard of
universe.
The song. Sorry, I never heard of this song. Yesterday?
Yeah.
And it deals with this group called the Beatles?
Right, and nobody knows them. In the movie, what a great idea. And then I was, it's a great idea. A guy wakes up in an alternate universe in which he is the only one who knows the Beatles songs. Nobody else has heard of the Beatles. Okay? And he's a struggling singer-songwriter. So he can sing, he can play, he can reproduce the songs, and so he has a big leg up. Suddenly, he has a great song catalog. He has amazing... So that's a great idea. The question is, are they going to be able to do something with that idea? Because that gets you... That's like a two-act out of a three-act story. It's like, okay, so, you know, he establishes it. It happens. He realizes. Then the next wave is he probably becomes successful because that's fun. And then what happens next? And they come up with stuff. And
one absolute brilliant moment.
And, yeah, and there's one really great moment in the movie.
It's a spoiler, folks. We're not going to tell you.
I think the movie is a little bit as a John Lennon man from way back, and I mean way back before he died. You know what I mean? Like it
before he went off on his own.
Yeah. By the way, I just received word that the embargo for Midsommar is over, so we can talk about Midsommar, and we can release the podcast a little bit earlier. That's great. Anyway, there's three things I want to say about this movie. One is that the movie, first of all, deals with the intangible thing of, like, will you become a star? Even if you have all those songs, there is also, you know, this is 2019. The Beatles came out in 63, really. They really hit big.
Yeah, 64 was Shea
but 64,
Stadium. Was the Shea Stadium.
Well, 64,
concert.
But the
main. Ed Sullivan.
Sullivan, yeah. So it's 1964. You know, you don't have Kennedy just got assassinated. You don't have musical taste being what they are. And you don't have four of the most charming guys on the planet doing the songs. In fact, the guy who does the songs, aside from the fact that he's a great singer and I guess he's a good musician. I guess that's really him playing. He's a rather unprepossessing guy. He's just like an average guy. He's not off-putting, but he's not Paul McCartney, you know. And Paul McCartney at 23 years old. So the movie makes you wonder if he's going to become a success. Another thing that the movie does, which is really interesting, I didn't think was possible, is that because we have a tendency in an audience to identify with the experience of the people on screen, the movie actually persuades us to hear the Beatles songs as if for the first time. When he plays Yesterday, and he thinks that he's playing a famous song to his friends, but they have never heard it, and they're listening to him hear the song, all of a sudden, I heard Yesterday, like probably for the first time since I was 7 years old. I mean, I know. Well, no, I mean, as if for the first time.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I mean, I dimly remember this as being an amazingly great song from when I was like starting, like first grade.
Never liked
it has since become Muzak.
Yeah.
And I haven't really particularly liked the song either, really.
Yeah.
It's not a song I ever play. It's been so oversaturated. But in the moment where he sings it, you kind of share in the experience.
Yeah.
And you also share in the experience of other songs. I do think the movie is a little bit McCartney heavy. I think it's a little McCartney heavy. I mean, when there's a moment in the movie where he has to play a song, him and Ed Sheeran, who's in the movie. I didn't know Ed Sheeran was a real rock star. That's how out of it I am. Ed Sheeran is in it playing himself.
I know who
himself.
Ed Sheeran is. I had to explain who Ed Sheeran
is.
I just want to justify, I know who Ed Sheeran is.
Yeah, and you're even older than I am.
That's right.
Anyway, so Ed Sheeran and him do a competition at one point, and Ed Sheeran writes a song, and then he writes a song, and of course he's not really writing the song. He's just and the song they pull out is an example of a really great song. Is The Long and Winding Road. And I guess they wanted to stick with the Beatles songbook, but I thought maybe it would be kind of cool to, you know, whip out Imagine or something. Or because you want to stick with the Beatles, you could do... I guess maybe Lennon was so eccentric. If he sat there and he sang I Am the Walrus, it might seem like, what are you talking about? But I think that would have been great.
Well, the Back in the USSR was an interesting thing.
That was great.
And they actually explained... It was, you know, that he was, you know, honoring the Soviet Union because, of course, the Soviet Union was in existence. They do a lot of small, clever things. You have Kate McKinnon as this obnoxious man, agent, I guess, in L.A.
And she's funny. She's
really
a lot
great.
Of the laughs.
She's
yeah.
really great. And at one point, he's singing some songs for the album, and he sings a Beatles song, which is great. Then he sings his own song. And it's just, that's his problem. He's a terrible composer.
He's not terrible. He's just mediocre.
Mediocre, I guess.
He's not terrible.
And you can see the difference. And I think that was a brilliant move by the director to show this is why he's doing this, because he's got greatness, and he doesn't have that greatness to compose.
Yeah,
And then there's the famous, and you've seen it on The Coming Attraction, so I'm not giving anything away, is when Ed Sheeran tells him to change the lyrics of Hey Jude to Hey Dude. And, of course, you're sitting there, and he gets stuck doing it. And then he goes, why did you say Hey Dude? He goes, don't talk about it.
Yeah. There's also something else that I thought was very sophisticated in this movie, yeah. and really sophisticated in the way it's treated. By the way, this is a Danny Boyle movie, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem like a Danny Boyle movie, except that it looks good. I mean, it's not fancy in the way it looks. It's just... It looks great, but it doesn't call attention to itself. And the movie never says this. It never says it. But you somehow get that feeling to inspire this kind. These songs are very powerful. These songs have the power to make somebody insanely famous, not just a little bit famous, and make audiences rabid and devouring. And the movie implies in a couple of very pointed ways that to become famous on this scale is actually dangerous. If you think about the Beatles, I mean, everybody knows the fact that one of the Beatles was killed by a crazy fan. But actually, another one was almost killed by a crazy fan. George Harrison, a lunatic, you know, busted into his house, stabbed him. He came with within a half inch of getting killed. It was just a maniac fan. So that's a 50% chance right there of driving people crazy.
And he never got over that either.
George Harrison?
Yeah, he never got over that. That was never revealed until later when he died, that he really had a lot of problems because of that.
Well, he was sick to begin with, but that may have pushed him into the grave a little bit earlier, because that kind of thing when you're very sick.
He was very badly hurt. And apparently he was, you know, it was touch and go there for a while.
Yeah, yeah. But for some reason, nobody knows that, because it doesn't have the same impact of course, what happened to John Lennon, because he lived, you know.
For those who don't know, he was killed on a Monday night football game. And what was the year, 1980?
December 8th, 1980.
80.
A date that will definitely live in infamy.
Yeah, 80 or 81?
80.
That's right. And he Was at the Dakota. He lived in the Dakota. Very upscale New York apartment building. And they were coming back, him and Yoko Ono, his wife at the time. And this madman just went and shot him. And I was watching Monday Night Football, and the great Howard Cosell actually interrupted the football game, and nobody cared about the game after that.
Well, yeah, and actually, it was a very interesting point in the game. It was in the fourth quarter, and the next play was actually rather amazing because one team was going to win, but actually, they kicked and they blocked the kick, and it was actually a really good game. But nobody remembers the game. But I was not watching football. I was in New York, and I did not find out in that way. Everybody else found out that way. But if you were in New York, or if your father played the horses like my father did, so he was listening to WINS. The first thing that we heard is that Lennon was shot. Then we heard that he was shot four times, and then we heard that he died. And this is over a span of about an hour. And so when I heard that John Lennon got shot, I thought that he got into an argument with somebody, and I didn't actually think it was serious. And then when I heard he was shot four times, then I thought, oh boy, this is bad. And then when they led with the news, when they started the hour, they said John Lennon was shot and killed today. And that was absolutely devastating. Okay. My friend of mine, we almost went to the Dakota, but then we just thought, what do we have to show off like all these other, you know, weirdos? Mm-hmm. But I would have to say, honestly, truly, I'm not over it. I'm not over it. You know, these things happen, and you know, if you were born in 1981, you can be over it. You know, but I'm not. I'm never going to be over it. I'm always going to feel bad because I remember I lived in a world that John Lennon was in. You know,
yeah, and I remember when I was little, not liking the Beatles because I was like, you know, in the anti-Beatles rock and roll club.
Yeah,
and I was really. Here's a 10-year-old who's the Stones and the Animals are much better. As I got a little older and Sgt. Pepper came out, and what was the album beforehand I really liked? Revolver or
Revolver's before Sgt. Pepper.
Right, and I started listening, and I go, this is really good stuff. And it got better and better when you had the White Album, and then you had the Abbey Road, which I think is a tremendous album.
Yeah. Second half of Abbey Road is just garbage.
I love that part.
well, no, I mean, the second half is you never give them your money, and there's good things in the second half, but then when it gets into that whole... That's just George Martin stuff. That's just putting together. You know, my wife the other day, my wife, my wife reads cookbooks all the time, and we had some beef and we had some chicken left over from different dinners, and so she read a way to like put all this stuff together and grind it up and make this incredible thing where you saute the meat and then you put it in like leaves of cabbage. Anyway, it was absolutely delicious. That is what George Martin did. He just took a bunch of scraps that were on the floor and he put it and he turned it into the second half of Abbey Road. But anyway, the point is, go back to the movie. These songs are dangerous, and maybe being famous from them is not the best thing to happen to a guy. We watch the movie and we root for him to have everything that he wants, and we want that to be the case. But sometimes maybe getting what you want is not the good thing. The other thing is we haven't mentioned Lily James.
Right. Well, we have, but not about the movie.
Yeah, not about the movie. She is... Delightful. Yeah, she is. She's really just, I mean, she's lovely. She's absolutely lovely. She is she's not the girlfriend. We have to believe, okay? Mm-hmm. We have to believe that she has really liked him, that guy, and he has never, like, noticed her, which is... that's okay, but I guess we're in the realm of fantasy to begin with. I mean, if you can believe in a world where nobody's heard of the Beatles, I guess you could believe in a world in which Lily James has to like go around for 5 years waiting for this guy to notice her. In any case, she's incredibly charming. She really is just perfectly lovely. She's been that way in every movie. Mm-hmm. By the way, she was in War and Peace, the British War and Peace. She playing Natasha, which is not exactly, you know, and who is it? Paul Dano played Pierre. I mean, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
It worked. It was actually good, and I'm very critical of
Warrens and
Peace.
I forgot that she was in Downton Abbey as well. She played Rose in Downton Abbey.
Lily James is in Downton Abbey?
Mm-hmm. Wow. I looked it up when I got home.
Is that how she became known?
Probably. You know, the Brit. It's weird in England because most of these people are getting well-known before they even hit television because they're on the stage, because the West End is still really important.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for example, one of the greatest actresses, English-speaking actress of our time, is rarely known in the United States because she doesn't make that many movies. But in England, she's like Dame Juliet Stevenson.
Oh.
And she's absolutely magnificent. You know her, but a lot of people just don't know her. Most of her fame is from the stage.
Juliet Stevenson.
Yeah, and most of her fame is from the stage.
How old is she? She's in her 60s?
No, she's got to be in her 60s by now.
Oh, I've seen her. Yeah. Okay.
But she's been in some wonderful movies. Very few, but she's very famous
you
in England.
You know her, too. You know her, too.
She's very, very famous in England. And the other one is not Emma Watson, but Emily Watson, has done a bunch of excellent movies, but again, isn't a superstar here. But in England, she is. Again, they go to the West End and do these incredible performances. So Lily might have, you know, already had a reputation. I don't know. Yeah. But and a lot of them get their reputation from EastEnders as well.
Don't you love going? I guess we can't get into a West End discussion, but don't you love the theater in London?
I love the safety curtain.
Oh, it's the safety curtain.
During the intermission, this big thing comes down.
Oh, yeah?
It's like this big safety curtain.
This is absolutely great. they even sell ice cream on intermission, although I never get it because I'm always
borderline. Yeah.
So anyway, I would say that movie. If you like the Beatles at all, go see that movie.
Yeah.
I do think it's a little McCartney heavy, but I do think they make up for it, sort of. But watch the movie, you'll see. It. By the way, I think Harrison gets as many songs as Lennon. Which is pretty funny.
Which ones?
We definitely got While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
That's a good one.
That's a great one, yeah.
That's a really good one.
So let's talk a little bit about last week. Just one movie.
Gabby.
What is that? Oh, yeah.
Gabby.
Toy Story 4.
Gabby is the evil doll. Based on Chatty Cathy, for those of us who are that
old. Oh, really? Oh,
and I actually, if you look at my Facebook or Twitter, I actually posted a picture of my Chatty Cathy that I still have.
Oh, did you post it in honor of this?
Yes, and I said that she was the inspiration.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is, I mean, I'm not going to get into details, but her voice box doesn't work.
Yeah, voice box, she can talk, but her voice box to the outside world doesn't talk.
Right, so, anyway.
I mean, you kind of wonder, why don't she just bypass that and just talk away?
Yeah.
These guys have figured out a way to just touch people. I mean, just the beginning of that movie, they're trying to rescue a toy. Then they're trapped inside the closet. You get this sense of very pure-hearted beings. They're worse off even than pets. They're pure-hearted beings who just want to be loved by people, and they want to be used, you know, made use of. But unlike pets, who usually are pretty safe until they start like soiling the carpet or something, or you know that kind of thing. These guys eventually get thrown out or given away, but usually, actually, they do wind up getting thrown out. And it's this awareness that is with us the whole time. We feel like, oh no, what's going to happen to these guys? I feel like I should go back because I'm not the biggest animation fan, although I keep on giving good reviews to animated films. So maybe what I really don't like is the animated films of the 90s.
Oh.
You know, because I hate all that.
But you have Toy Story in there. Isn't there a Toy Story in there?
I never saw Toy Story. I never saw the first Toy Story. I saw Toy Story 3, and I thought it was like a masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece.
I never saw Toy Story 1 or 2. The reason I got off of animation because I started going all these animated films in the 90s, and they were all about the same thing, the exact same story. There's a misfit in the kingdom. The kingdom is imperiled, and the misfit has to save the kingdom. And how many times are I going to watch this movie? And I just said I don't want to see this stuff anymore. But now they've gone on to other things. And the last Toy Story movie was great. I think this one is, I don't know if this is great, but it's pretty moving, and it's, you know, it's like 3.25 stars out of 4, maybe 3.5. I don't know. But anyway, Woody, Woody, that's his name. He's the sheriff.
Woody.
Yeah, Woody's the sheriff.
Woody.
Yeah, Woody takes it upon himself to keep on saving this other sort of toy from destroying himself by throwing himself in the garbage because he's just kind of stupid. And Sporky. And
I recognize that voice immediately.
I didn't.
That's Tony Hale. I didn't get Bo because the person who plays Bo Peep is much older. That's Andy
right.
Potts.
Yeah.
But I got Sporky like that. Oh,
yeah.
I said, that's Tony Hale.
Bo Peep, Andy Potts, the combination. And where are you going to get anybody to tell you something like this, folks? I mean, you can only hear it here. The combination of Annie Potts' voice and the animation of Bo Peep, she looks like she was like Gloria Graham, actually. Yeah.
I really like the fact that Bo Peep is, first she said, oh God, Bo Peep, come on, people. And she's so empowered in this movie. It was like, I actually felt these toys were real.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you've seen animation, you know that they're toys or they're this. But this one, for some reason, I just kept feeling they were real. Even the dinosaur, you know, Wallace Shawn, I just felt that there was a reality to them. That I felt like I could walk on the street and go, hey, Woody, how you doing, you know?
I mean, I would say, if you see it, it's a really good movie. even if you think that you won't like it, and of course most people are not like me, they actually think they will like it. But I always go into these movies. I go into every animated film skeptical. I really do, because you're not really seeing people's faces, and all I'm interested in acting is basically the human beings presenting themselves to other human beings. That's what acting is. But I love this. I mean, love is great. It's too big a word. I really, 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 really liked it.
Yeah,
I thought it was kind of wonderful.
By the way, Gabby, who's based on the Chatty Cathy, that's a voice I didn't get, which was Christina Hendricks from Mad Men.
But
you have to see her and her bodyguards, I guess you can call them. I'm not going to give away the bodyguards.
The bodyguards. Oh yeah. All right. So anyhow, so let's.
Let's go to
the future.
Let's go to
because the embargoes have both lifted.
And why don't you take a mini break and let Peter Hartlob talk about Spider-Man.
Yeah, Peter's going to tell us about Spider-Man. What is the name of the movie? The official name?
Spider-Man: Far From Home.
Yeah,
it's the first movie after Avengers: Endgame. So we've saved the world. We're all back. Half of humanity is back.
But so and so isn't here.
Tony Stark, Iron Man, is dead. That's not a spoiler anymore.
Oh, no.
Everybody's seen the movie by now.
Well, so. is he dead at the start of this movie?
Yeah, he's dead. I mean, there's murals for him up there. He's gone and being memorialized.
Hey, look, all bets are off for the first 20 minutes of story.
Yeah.
You got to say what the movie's about. Tony's dead. Wow.
Tony's dead. Well, he died in Endgame.
Oh, I know he did.
So, you know.
I've been busted to say so.
Over the calls for an innuendo on this.
Yeah. The innuendo was very subtle. It was like, Tony Stark is dead. That was the
No, I didn't. You said, maybe we see Tony Stark in the next movie. I said, I don't think so.
Yeah, it was like, Tony Stark, we're not going to be seeing him no more.
I said, I don't think so.
Anyway, so tell us about it. Tell us.
Well, you know, I mean, where are they going to go? They've already saved the world. They've already had a million aliens coming and fighting them. So they go way back in two different ways. They decide that Spider-Man doesn't want to be an Avenger. He wants to be a high school kid. And very, very funny. Like, Nick Fury is trying to get a hold of him because, like, there's the world that needs to be saved from other little threats. And he won't answer his call. He's ghosting Nick Fury to go on his European trip and ask his girlfriend out. That's what he wants to do. And then, on the other hand, just the tone of it, they've got the writer and director from Ant-Man and the first Spider-Man who makes it funny, worked with Paul Rudd, you know, just really works with a comic script. And all the things we've been taking super seriously with the Marvel Universe movies for the last few years, you know, half of the people disappearing, the memorials, Captain America standing in front of the memorial, all that's gone. We're making fun of it now.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they call it The Blip. And the movie opens with like an AV club, a couple of high school students doing their tribute to all the people who have fallen. But it's just high school AV club, totally ridiculous and funny.
Oh, wow.
And they show slapstick scenes of everybody disappearing and coming back, something that they never would have done in an Avengers movie because it's so serious. Yeah. And I think that was the right way to go. The movie itself, Far From Home, Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio, and he's kind of like a new figure, new hero or villain. And, you know, they take it in this direction that's just much smaller scale. And I like it. I mean, you can't go bigger, so pull it back and make it more of a human thing and make it funny. Mm-hmm. You know, all the memes we've been seeing about Avengers movies and Twitter memes and people making fun of it, this movie does that. And they do it actually better.
Yeah.
So it was enjoyable. It It had a few pacing problems. They put it out just 2 years after the first Spider-Man Homecoming, and I think that was too short of a period. Reminded me of the Iron Man films, where it seems like they brought it out too quickly. But enjoyable movie, and it's where they had to go.
Yeah, I like
Tom Holland, too. I like him in a way that he's a lot more naive than the other two that played the part.
Yeah.
He plays it like with this, like oh boy kind of thing.
He's
like,
got a vulnerability. He's got a vulnerability that's believable. Yeah. And it's hard to believe because he's got all these powers. Yeah, so why would he be vulnerable?
He sort of has a wonder to him. Like, he's wondering. And the others are like, I'm Peter Parker.
I like Tobey Maguire.
Yeah. I liked him too, but I think this is a different, like, angle. They play a more, like, you know, older and more wiser than this one's, like, just learning.
Yeah, that's true. Really this meets him early in his career.
It's just something different, and it's just very nice to see somebody who's able to, like, not imitate them, actually.
Yeah.
Everybody's, like, dead or off with the Guardians of the Galaxy. There aren't, like, 50 heroes that you have to serve in this film.
I know, yeah.
So it allows it to be 2 hours long. And then some of the secondary characters really get some good moments.
Yeah.
Jon Favreau, who plays Happy Hogan, he's kind of like Tony Stark's body man. Mm-hmm. All we've seen him do in these movies is hand someone a briefcase or, like, console someone when they're sad. He actually gets to be a character here.
Okay.
We get to learn a little bit about him. He's funny.
He was a producer on the movie too, I'm guessing.
He's involved with a lot of stuff. He's a big name. But a couple guys come in. Martin Starr and J.B. Smoove come in and play the two teachers who are chaperoning this European trip. And they're given time to be funny. And, you know, they're the dorky, don't quite want to be there, but a little bit too strict about the rules chaperones. I just liked it. It pulled back.
Do people have to stay through the credits?
I didn't. I ran to my BART train because I wanted to get home, and I didn't stay to the credits, so I'm going to have to go back again. I'm sure I missed
because in Avengers, they actually told us we didn't have to stay for the end of the credits.
Yeah, nobody told me not to. Yeah. I just was like, it was one of those things where they check in the phones and the backpacks, so I was running to get my phone. Otherwise, I was going to be another half hour and miss my BART train, so... Is that an ethical issue that I didn't see the end credit stinger?
No, I just know that.
As soon as the credits start, you can leave.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. Sometimes, like, the credits continue with some action, which was yesterday. I think had that going on a little bit.
Yeah, as soon as the credits come on, you can stand up. If if you notice that they are still showing part of the movie, then you have the option to sit down or watch the rest of it from the wings. But to me, you know, when they're hitting you with credits, that means the movie's over, unless there's more dialogue, and then you have to sit there. But the one thing that I don't think you have to do is to sit through 10 minutes of credits to just see their commercial for the next movie.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so do you want
to... Although, I have to say, the first Avengers with the shawarma, totally worth sitting through the last 10 minutes for the shawarma.
I'll wait for video. I'm still waiting. One more.
One more movie. It's called Midsummer, not to be confused with Midsummer Murders on PBS.
That's right. that's right. And it's spelled like that. It's, well, I haven't written this yet. And so you're going to hear, like, you know, me kind of being kind of incoherent. This is a very weird movie. And I have very strong feelings about it. I think there's no question that the guy who made the movie can make movies. I mean, it's very clear that this person is really talented within maybe 5 minutes, and that he has his own way of doing things. He's a young director. Forgot his name, but we'll know it soon. But on the other hand, the movie is really kind of awful, too. It's so weird. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And it's about these people who get invited to go to Sweden, but not to Stockholm, but to go to northern Sweden for some festival that they're told, they're like, some of them are anthropology majors or something, and say, it's going to be interesting. You can do a paper about it. You can do a thesis about it. So they go, and it's one Swedish guy who's telling them, yeah, come with me. You're going to love it. So they go, all go up there. And And it's and the people are very nice and they're very Swedish and everything's great and everybody has flowers in their hair. And then things start getting bad. And basically, this is an insane cult. One of the aspects of the cult is that everybody is that they believe that life has seasons and each season is 18 years. So the first season is childhood, second season is adulthood, and third season, I guess, is more adulthood. And then finally, it's old age. And then when you're 72, you have to kill yourself. and the scene of this woman, it's so disgusting. This woman jumps off a thing and purposely lands face first on and body first onto a rock. And then immediately you get, of course, the close-ups of her smashed-in face. Then her old friend, he's next up, he misses the rock. He lands, and he's like, he's doing that. And so they come over with the ceremonial mallet and start smashing his face in, and you see that. And it's totally disgusting. So much of this movie is so disgusting and ultimately silly and pointless, but tense. I mean, once you get on to what's going on with this movie, and it doesn't take long, it certainly doesn't take 2 hours and 20 minutes, you know where this is heading. You start feeling like, come on. You know, get somebody else to write the script next time. I don't even know. I'm assuming the guy wrote the script. I haven't written the review yet, but it had the feeling of something that the person wrote themselves.
Is it, what language is it in?
It's in English. Because
and who stars in it? Do we know?
Oh, well, Florence Pugh,
the
British actress. Yeah, she's very good. But it's really a combination of kind of really good filmmaking and still an awful movie. You know, you can't. Oh, yeah, he wrote it. And I see. I'm right. Yeah. I'm right because it had the feeling of something that somebody wrote themselves because. Another director would say, you know, if it was somebody else's script, they'd say, okay, we can cut this part out. It's not, we don't need this. It's not necessary. Yeah, this has the real self-indulgent quality about it, but kind of garbage made by a talented person. You know, like some of those bad Tarantino movies, you know? Mm-hmm. The talent was obvious, even, you know, in a movie like Kill Bill.
Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah, Kill Bill, which I hated.
Volume 1 you hated.
Yeah, I like Volume 2. You're the few people who actually... could pull that fact out of the thin air. Yeah, or even like
they did what you suggested.
Where they
combined the two into one movie.
Did they cut down?
Yeah, I think they cut. Yeah, you saw, you liked it, I think.
No, I never saw the cut down version.
I thought you got the DVD.
I never. You know, no, what happened with Kill Bill, and then I think we'll end on this, is what happened with Kill Bill is it came out, they screened it for critics, and then having seen it, I was ready to write the review, and then they edited it. They said, we're going to do another edit on it, and I had to go back and see this movie that I hated again and write a second story about the changes.
See, my memory is different.
Yeah?
My memory is you had to go back to count the violence.
Well, that was like the side benefit of it. What happened is that I wrote the review, but then they re-edited it. They took out some things, so I had to go back and see it again to say that. And then while we were at it, we had the fun of like saying there were, I think we did a little bit of a Joe Bob Briggs on that, which is, you know, reference to the past, but you would count all these things that happened. Anyway, Leba.
And we tried to compare, I think we tried to compare it to The Passion of the Christ, if I'm not mistaken.
They came out around the same time, and people were very mad at me from very different sides of the political spectrum, interestingly. Yeah, that's funny.
The ketchup factor.
Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, listen, as always, a pleasure, huh, Leba? It's nice hanging out.
This
is great.
Today, yeah. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Yeah, and so anyway, come back, I guess, in a couple of weeks for another thrilling and exciting Movies with Mick LaSalle. I'm Mick LaSalle, and signing off.
I'm Leba Hertz.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks to Mick LaSalle and Leba Hertz. Our producer today is me, Peter Hartlob. Supervising producers are King Kaufman and Libby Coleman. Executive producer is Tim O'Rourke. And our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is Midnight Special by Ease Jammy Jams. Read our columns and subscribe to The Chronicle at www.sfchronicle.com. Chronicle podcasts are on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.